Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 28th of January 2018. My name is DRP Watson and this time I'm joined by Gareth James, Web Cowgirl, Laura Cressley and Johnny Fox. We're now going to talk about Barnum at the Minier Chocolate Factory. This is a 1980 musical with music by Cy Coleman, lyrics by Michael Stewart and a book by Mark Bramble. It is directed here by Gordon Greenberg, with choreography by Rebecca Howell, and set and costume design by Paul Farnsworth. It stars Marcus Brigstocke, Topeli Dorgu, Harry Francis, Laura Pitt-Pulford, and Celinde Schoenmaker. The cast also includes Danny Collins, Eamon Cox, Rosie Fletcher, Ainsley Hall-Ricketts, Courtney Howes, Bethany Huckle, Kelsey Jameson, Preston Jameson, Philip Marriott, Dominic Owen, Megan Poulet, Lucy May Sumner, and Owen Winship. Barnum has been in the West End a few times before, most famously in 1981 when it became the sort of third coming of Michael Crawford. He was sort of a young film star in the 1960s, a television star with some of us who have him in the 1970s, and then this became his first, well, not his first big musical role, but I think the first one that made him a musical star rather than a TV star, I think. He really took on this role and ran it for a number of years in London. And it also had a little bit of fame in 1983 when the ice dance duo Torval and Dean used it to gain practically the first ever perfect score in a free ice dance at the World Championships. Used music from Barnum to do this. Of course, most people either remember them using Mac and Mabel or Ravel's Bolero. Gareth, tell me more about this production, what you thought of it.
I first saw Barnum with Michael Crawford back all that time ago and didn't see it again for many, many years until I think about 5 years ago when it was at the Chichester Festival Theatre when they built a big top outside the theatre while they were renovating the theatre. So seeing it at the Mania Chocolate Factory was a completely different experience because it's on a completely different scale. And I was kind of expecting it not to be a suitable venue, really. But as it turns out, you know, it's in the round. It's quite a big floor to play on. It doesn't have the height, obviously, as either the Palladium or the Big Top, but it actually did combine sort of enough room for spectacle with some intimacy as well, really. And there is a sort of frisson of having a man juggling with knives quite close to your face. So I thought it did work in the Chocolate Factory. I avoid press nights because I think that you rarely see a show at its best on press night because there's too much pressure on the performers. And I think this one appears to have had a bad press night because the press were very lukewarm at best to it. But I saw it just 2 days after, and even though it does have its faults, I actually was much more positive than the critics were about it. Since it opened, of course, the film The Greater Story has come out, which is about Barnum with obviously a different sort of thing, but Barnum as a sort of a real character has therefore perhaps got more prominence than before. It's a very American story. He's a real-life showman, he's proprietor of a circus, or indeed even a sort of museum, really. And in a way, they're more like freak shows than anything else, because they feature, you know, the world's oldest woman, the bearded woman, the tiny Tom Thumb. And he basically promotes these shows. He brings Swedish opera singer Jenny Lind over to America. He eventually goes into politics, not as far as others who've gone into politics from showmanship have got. And he eventually goes back to the circus and creates this Barnum and Bailey partnership. So it's a real life story and a very, very American story. Cy Coleman's score, I think, is very good. It's got some great tunes, and it's particularly good at the chorus and ensemble pieces. So you've got some great set pieces like One Brick at a Time and Come Follow the Band and Join the Circus, which are terrific. And really, you know, that's the real strength of the show in this production, because I thought the ensemble was great at singing, dancing, and it's also full of circus skills as well, some of which, quite frankly, take your breath away. So I thought that was the strength of this particular production. Laura Pitt-Pulford, as Barnum's wife Cherry, is very, very good. Topele Dorgu is a Corrie exile, and she proves as good to be on stage as she was on the small screen. Marcus Brigstocke has come in for a lot of flack. I thought he was okay. Personally, I don't think he's a good enough singer or a seasoned enough performer to take what is a really, really big show role in Barnum. But, you know, his likability worked to his favour, and he certainly stayed on the tightrope the night we went. So, you know, I thought he pulled it off, but just. I think that's would be my summing up of it. I thought Paul Farnsworth's design was very good. He sort of does turn it into a very circusy atmosphere. Gordon Greenberg's staging is good, but in particular Rebecca Howell's choreography I thought was sensational, because she's responsible for delivering the spectacle I think the show actually needs. Because it's in the round, there's some sideline issues. You know, we missed some moments which were on an elevated platform in front of the band, but for us behind a pillar, and there were a few other things behind us, but overall I think it's a very good use of the Meunier stage. So I went with lowered expectations because of the critics. I haven't read them, but you can't miss the stars really, and I actually came out being you know, quite satisfied. It wasn't the best of the three productions I've seen. It wasn't the best Barnum I've seen, but I thought it was an interesting thing to put into the Meunier, and for me it was an enjoyable night.
So Will Cowgirl, what did you think about this?
Walking into the auditorium of the Meunier, you couldn't help but feel that every penny of the many pounds that you spent on your ticket was right there in front of you. Fantastic costumes, circus paraphernalia everywhere, and entertainers that look like they had been skimmed off of the upper crust of the London circus glitterati. You know, not quite Cirque du Soleil, but there was a lot happening and the energy levels were really high. I saw it the first week and people were really enthused about this. And in fact, the woman sitting next to me had been just 2 days before and bought a ticket to come back. But pretty much as soon as we got into the story of the play of P.T. Barnum's rise to fame, his success more or less as an entrepreneur, his relationship with his wife, and all of the other things that came together to make the story, I kind of felt like we had been given this wonderful buffet of ingredients, and yet nobody had really thought about how you would put them together to make a really good meal. The songs that held the show together didn't illuminate character a whole lot. They sort of gave us historical information, told us about, you know, who Tom Thumb was, explained a little bit maybe about how perhaps Barnum was pushing people and fussing with the truth. But they, as songs, as pieces of music, there just wasn't a lot of sparkle to them. So they were serviceable, like an old Volvo. It gets you from place to place and, you know, make sure that you and your kids arrive in one piece. But there was no oomph, no room, no super, super pizzazz when we were looking at the story and the music that was telling it. However, there was a constant panoply of performances happening, like pretty much about, like, you know, every 5 to 10 minutes, there'd be some kind of like circus thing happening. And I was infinitely distracted by the jugglers, the balancing acts, people doing backflips. I mean, the talent that supported this was absolutely fantastic. The only moment, though, where I really felt like I was being swept away on the artistry of the show itself were in the bits where Jenny Lind was on stage, played by Celine Schoenmaker. Her voice enraptured me. She was a complete delight, and the pieces written for Jenny Lind let her soar, and I was, you know, carried away on this vision of what it was to see, you know, the Swedish Nightingale. It was fantastic, and especially if you consider how the story of American popular culture is so often written on what's considered to be like the lowest common denominator of like whatever people will pay for is what is provided, you know, monster truck rallies. To think of somebody going around the country singing opera to packed houses and of a circus promoter who was putting this woman on stage, it was, you know, I found it really exciting. And I was thinking I would love to see her in something else again, because pretty much after she stopped being on stage and we got back to the sort of day-to-day humdrum existence of Barnum and his wife Charity, I lost my interest. I waited to have more people doing backflips and other acrobatics on stage, but I wanted more fireworks in the performances. And unfortunately, with such a tremendous supporting cast, you've in essence tried to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. I don't think this musical really deserved a revival, and I understand, you know, pickings can be slim, and you always hope that when you go back through the back catalog, you're going to find some golden glory waiting to be rediscovered. But this wasn't it, and I think I can pretty definitively say that, unlike the woman sitting next to me, I will never again in my entire life attend a performance of Barnum, and it does not matter who they put in the lead role or the supporting roles or how great the environment creation is, because we did have a wonderfully recreated circus inside of the Meunier. I only wished I was there to see a better show. I hate to see 3 months, 4 months devoted to cranking out something like this night after night, because unfortunately Barnum didn't deserve the effort in the first place.
We're now going to talk about Hamilton, the musical. This is a sung through and rapped through musical about the life of Alexander Hamilton, an American founding father. I'm not entirely sure what the definition of that is, but Alexander Hamilton, after the Constitutional Congress, was instrumental in getting the Constitution accepted through his work on things like the Federalist Papers. He was an aide-de-camp to George Washington during the American Revolution, and also commanded troops during the American Revolution towards the end. He was America's first Treasury Secretary, and in some ways he put America on a sound financial footing and defined what America would be financially, and against the wishes of other people, as we find out. Now, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote this musical, was inspired by the 2004 biography of Alexander Hamilton by Ron Chernow, and decided to take this story, the story of an immigrant, possibly illegitimate, who comes to America and makes good, and thought that would make a very interesting tale for the story. And there's plenty of very interesting things about Alexander Hamilton's life which you can use in this, and he has produced what is widely thought of as a, you know, a major piece of art, a really great musical, I think. This has been running on Broadway since 2015. It has basically been completely sold out, and you can't get tickets anywhere. And it has now opened in the West End at the Victoria Palace Theatre. The West End stars are Jamel Westman as Alexander Hamilton, Rochelle Anne Goh as Eliza Hamilton, Giles Torreira as Aaron Burr, Rachel John as Angelica Schuler, Jason Pennycook as the Marquess of Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, Obiomia Ugala as George Washington, Michael Gibson as King George III, Cleve September as John Lawrence and Philip Hamilton, Christine Aliardo as Peggy Schuler and Maria Reynolds, Taryn Callender as Hercules Mulligan and James Madison, and it has garnered pretty much 5-star reviews. Laura, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
Well, it's a great musical, first of all. Let's get that out of the way. It is an absolutely brilliant musical. The writing by Lin-Manuel Miranda is what makes it, and that includes the composition as well. So not just the lyrics, also the book and the music is extraordinary. The way he weaves hip-hop in and around more conventional styles of music, or I say more conventional, I mean the sort that you would expect to see on stage in a musical rather than what you'd hear on the radio or anything like that. It's fantastic, and he gives these characters such an amazingly rich vocabulary in his writing, and you can also hear his influences. They go from Shakespeare to contemporary hip-hop artists and everyone else in between. And it is a really, really stunning book. And the music is super catchy and really fun. And I don't think you have to be a hip hop fan to appreciate it. I'm not particularly into hip hop per se. I can appreciate it, but I'm not all up to date on current artists or anything like that. And the energy behind it is truly extraordinary. And it's that energy that really fits with the characters that he's created. There's a line that says they're young, scrappy and hungry. And that's so totally accurate. It's this group of young men who are at the forefront of something new, something exciting, something incredibly uncertain. And they get together, not always in a friendly way, and they don't always agree on things, to get America up and running. And what struck me pretty quickly was how the attitudes of these young men really strongly parallel the Leave campaign here in Britain. That idea that in America, they were rejecting this distant foreign tyrant who was bringing in all these laws and rules and things like that they totally objected to. And we're getting that in the Leave campaign here. The idea of sovereignty is one of the major principles of the Leave campaign. But also between the two sets of characters, if we can call them that, there's a real optimism and a real belief that leaving the motherland, as it were, and setting up independently and making your own country that you completely control will be better. But on the other hand, now my full disclaimer here is I totally support the Remain campaign. I'm about as anti-leave as you can get, is that there's a real arrogance behind that as well. And there's a real willful refusal to listen to the other side. And we see that in Hamilton too. Hamilton himself, the character in this show, we see a real arrogance. He's very quick to get into arguments. He will interrupt other people who he disagrees with and just steamroll them. And there's some people in the Leave campaign that I can see those traits in as well. They refuse to listen. They refuse to really negotiate politely or be polite at all, and just really steamroll the opposition and go for what they want without any regard of another opinion or argument or side to the issue. So as much as I love Hamilton as a piece of musical theatre in terms that it's brilliantly crafted. The performances are excellent as well in this original cast. There's some quite disturbing parallels to Brexit Britain. Not that I think the creative team should have changed the show or anything at all, but I'll be really interested to see, as the show gains momentum and as more British audiences see it, if the Leave campaign maybe not fully appropriates it, but it takes a lot of that optimism that they see in these founding fathers and use that in their own thinking as a justification. The whole thing that we see in this show is that everything's going to be fine. And whilst there is conflict, whilst there is struggle, of course, because it's a story and it's not entirely historically accurate, the difficulty in actually setting up a new country is very much glossed over in this musical. And again, I look at the Leave campaign and very often think to myself that they don't quite see how difficult it's going to be to actually leave the EU and bring in all of these rules and regulations that they need to bring in, that previously, or as is now, as part of the EU, all of that legislation covered us, covered the UK. But now it's really starting from scratch in a lot of ways. So I do see quite a lot of parallels between these so-called founding fathers in Hamilton and in America's history and the Leave campaign here. They have very similar aims, very similar personality traits, and a real, very similar arrogance and just sort of going for it no matter what. And in Hamilton himself, that is his tragic flaw, and it ends quite badly for him at the end of the show. Whilst I don't necessarily see we'll have duels out in remote parts of the country here in the UK, whilst people work out their political differences. Some of the conflicts we're seeing coming out of Brexit are incredibly nasty and really vicious in terms of the two sides going after each other, and it's just not very pleasant. Whilst this doesn't necessarily affect the quality of Hamilton at all, it's just a really interesting framework, I find, to see the show in. And American audiences won't necessarily perceive this, but British audiences may pick up on this a lot more and see those parallels. And seeing the musical within the context of Brexit Britain is a very striking experience. There were parts of the show where I felt quite disturbed, actually, because you know where the musical's going if you're familiar with it when you go into the show, and just how ruthless these characters can be, and how nasty and how relentless. And you do kind of worry a bit that in this country the Brexit negotiators are driving us very quickly towards a cliff because they refuse to listen to other sides or negotiate more effectively or things like that. But at the same time, I thoroughly enjoyed the show. Lin-Manuel Miranda is clearly a creative genius. His compositions and his lyrics are wonderful. I've been listening to the soundtrack well before I saw the show, and thoroughly enjoying it. And seeing it on stage was incredible. It is an incredible piece of theatre, but I did come out of it feeling a bit disturbed because of the way that the show could be read in the context of Brexit Britain.
John, what did you think about Hamilton?
Well, before we discuss Laura's party political broadcast, I just want to say how much I enjoyed what Cameron McIntosh has done with the theatre. I think I saw Billy Elliot at the Victoria Palace in one of its last late performances, and it really was looking extremely tired and shabby, and I think there was even linoleum in the stalls. It just wasn't a comfortable venue. And I think what has been done in partnership between Cameron McIntosh and his female designer, whose name I'm sorry I can't remember, but she's worked on a lot of his renovations, is dramatic, really. And the important boxes have all been ticked. You know, the seats are comfortable and everything works. And I think that applying this Viennese secessionist glamour to the Victoria Palace is a stroke of real genius. And you know, for those who don't know, my background as well as theatre is in architecture, and I was fascinated by how they would bring this theatre back to life without just making it look like a Victorian red plush and gilt box. So widening the stage as well makes the Victoria Palace for me now look like a two-thirds scale London Coliseum, and that also adds to the sense of occasion. And I think it feels as though London now has a generously made, purpose-built musical theatre. Apart from anything else, the lighting and sound equipment are absolutely perfection. You can really hear every word. So in a way, it's a little bit unfortunate that Hamilton's going to occupy it for quite so long, because I can think of a dozen other great musicals that would benefit from staging in such a handsome and attractive setting. But Hamilton suits it, because Hamilton is also slick and lavish and a glorious parade of movement and dance. I think Andy Blankenbuehler is one of the best American choreographers, and what comes here is really seamless. It's a constant athletic cavalcade. And if there's a little bit of homoeroticism, well, you can overlook it. But it's very obvious that the male chorus are frequently meant to stretch and flex their pecs and glutes in cut-off muscle tops all through the first half, and they arch their backs in breeches and leather boots as if they were the Chippendales. It's not necessarily, well, it's not historically accurate, and it's not necessarily a way to underline the narrative of the story, but it knows its crowd and it knows how to entertain them. Musically, I think Hamilton is almost as complex as the plot, which I won't try and explain. I have to say also that I tried to come to Hamilton as untainted as possible by the hype from America. I hadn't heard the CD. I've really not been greatly exposed to it, except to the phenomenon that, you know, massive money was made on ticket resales and so on. So I didn't really know, apart from the heraldry that came before, the trumpeting, that it was a rap musical. And that really made me a bit apprehensive, because I'm not a fan of rap music, and then Laura said she isn't either, so that's something, one thing we agree on. And it's true that there's a lot of fast patter and internal rhyme in the lyrics and the recitative, but I thought it was so well done and so cleanly enunciated that you could forget that this comes from a gang heritage of hip-hop. In fact, it comes from gang violence in the South Bronx. It's not a pleasant origin for any kind of music. It's very grimy and very violent. But I thought that it was also a really clever updating of opera. You know, if you listen to the recitative in the Barbara Seville, for example, there's a lot of very chatty stuff. And I thought that Lin-Manuel Miranda was possibly tapping into that heritage as well. So I think that Hamilton reboots the through-sung musical theatre story as cleverly and as assuredly as Evita did in 1978. And it will colour what comes after it. Besides, the hip-hop and the opening pattern very soon gives way to a lot of proper songs that you might recognise as ballads or R&B or pop or soul, or any musical genre you care to name. And it's really significant that as a composer, lyricist and playwright, Lin-Manuel Miranda can turn his hand equally to all of them. And the only other person I can think of who has that sort of flexibility and capability to produce a song in so many genres that then makes you think, and Stephen Sondheim. And I think he may have his natural heir and successor in Mr. Miranda. I would cut the number of songs, there are 37 of them, if only to limit the whooping and whistling of the audience. It's unfortunate that the hype has got through to a lot of the audience and they are recognising what they've heard on the CD. And in the case of Two Young Women, Three Seats Away from Me, they mind every word. But I think it would be better to cut the quantity of songs and to extend the best ones. Should we talk about the performances? Three absolute standouts for both acting and musical excellence. It's clever that the show is not designed to have a star, and it's fortunate, really, because I don't think the guy playing Alexander Hamilton is perfection, and it will be interesting when Lin-Manuel Miranda comes to play it himself in a year or so, and maybe people go back and see how he does it. But the three performances that stood out for me, I think the real star is Giles Torreira, an actor I've been following for a while, who plays Vice President Aaron Burr. And he's kind of conducting and comparing the Battle of Yorktown like he was a sort of 18th century Sammy Davis Jr. He has magnificent stage presence and a really endlessly pleasing voice, which is good because I have an awful lot to sing. Jason Pennycook, you might remember as the very camp Jacob the Maid in the original Menier production of La Cage aux Folles. And he makes Lafayette, I would say, even camper than Jacob. But, oh my word, can that man throw shapes? And then in between all of it, all the politics and the bloodshed and the campery, you've got Michael Gibson's hilarious King George III, you know, standing at the side of the stage with his arms folded going, is that all you've got kind of thing, which I really love. And he's a real audience favourite. And although clinically mad, I thought at times he was the only sane one in the asylum of revolutionary backstabbers. Talking of revolutionary backstabbers, just pick up for a moment on Laura's Brexit point. There's no way that this production can be connected to the separation of Britain from the European Union, because apart from anything else, it was written in 2012, long before we'd first had a referendum. But I didn't read that. If it had a point to make, it was about the fluid diversity in the casting. And that I really liked because it felt unselfconscious. So often you will see a production where, you know, there's a token Asian, token Black, token whatever, to fill up some kind of quota. And that to me feels nonsensical. But here it just seemed a little bit more natural. And what it did, I thought, was unselfconscious and apolitical, except to indicate how the United States evolved as a melting pot of many cultures. And I also thought it was ironic that for many years, the Victoria Palace was the home of the black and white minstrel show, which was the exact opposite end of the sort of racial stereotyping spectrum. So maybe in some ways it still is. But I was very pleased to have gone, very grateful for a press ticket, and I definitely thought it was an occasion and something to be enjoyed and commended, even if it's not your thing. So, Webcow Girl, tell us when you went, what you thought, and how you enjoyed it.
Well, it's kind of embarrassing for me to be the only person that I have spoken to that didn't like Hamilton. Well, let me talk a little bit about why. I'm actually really, really familiar with Alexander Hamilton as a political writer and political thinker. And when they talk about the Federalist Papers early on in the play, I was so excited because, you know, not only am I getting to see my history on stage, which was exciting for me, but I'm actually seeing a person celebrated whose works and thoughts I had studied in depth, although not his personal life. And to get into a discussion of how government ought to be organized and what sort of rights do citizens have and how do you want to balance the power of the states versus the nation, all of these things, you know, I'm probably also the only person in this country who's seen that musical who was excited that this is some of the stuff that we were going to talk about. And the man they have as Hamilton, Jamail Westman, had the kind of charisma that absolutely could carry the show. He was electrifying with everybody else, but he just had such confidence in himself. You know, as his character, he was completely confident in himself, but as an actor, he was up there, he was the center of attention, and everybody in the audience was eating out of his hand. And wow, the power of being there, even in my really, really crummy second balcony seats that were actually nice and cheap, was overwhelming. I hadn't been to an experience like that in terms of the energy levels since I went and saw Hairspray back in the day. It was wonderful to be there and to see a cast that represented the truth of the diversity of America and what Americans are. Because even though a lot of this history was made by races of people from around the world and not just from Europe, America's success is just as much about the success of all of this place as it is about, I don't know, Europeans coming over and sharing their enlightenment with the great unwashed, or however you want to put it. But unfortunately for me, the musical style that Lin-Manuel Miranda put this in didn't work. I couldn't follow along with the lyrics a lot of the time. It was just too fast, too dense. I mean, it was like, what, 2.5, 3 hours entirely in patter song? You just can't absorb that much information. And, you know, it was probably a 10-hour play if it had been done in a different musical style. It was just so much, so heavy, so fast. And it didn't have musical hooks to pull me in. I love walking out of a musical and singing some of the songs, and it still happens for new musicals that people write things that are good enough that you go out of the theater and you're saying, "Good morning, Baltimore," or, you know, "Everyone's a little bit racist sometime," or whatever it is. People are still writing really great songs, but I've never felt that rap was very tuneful. It's a great way to cram a lot of words into a really short space. And the other thing, I started feeling like so much of the choreography, like the, you know, lift the legs up to the knees and stomp them down and kind of jerk forward with your arms straight, and it just all started to feel really samey, like I was watching a music video choreographed in the 90s. And that was disappointing because the voices of the people on stage were really good and those people could move. And if they had had better songs to sing and choreography that wasn't so locked into matching the musical vernacular, maybe it would have been a richer experience. I was seeing next to all the brother and sister, and the 14-year-old had actually just come back to see the show a second time. And He loved it. He was so excited about it. And there I was, and I just didn't care. And I wanted this to be like the best new thing on the stage in the last 5 years. I wanted this to be the show where I was going to be sitting there looking for returns every day, and they've got them. That's how I got my tickets. But it wasn't. If you don't like rap music, this could very much not be the show for you. And considering how sold out it is and how expensive a whole lot of the seats are, you know, maybe that's for the best. There's other things out there. This is not the be-all and end-all, the great multiracial hope. It's great for the future of musical theater, but I kind of hope that in 20 years, maybe another musical genre will be in vogue, and then I can go listen to this one, because even if someone gave me a ticket to Hamilton for free, I wouldn't go back. I look forward to seeing what Jamel Westman's going to be up to, because that star is shooting high, and he was absolutely rocking it. And my God, the trio with Eliza Hamilton, Angelica Schuler, and the other sister just knocked me out of my chair. That was like the best moment of the whole thing. And kind of like after that, it never really happened for me. Even when the many deaths came and the sadness came in the second act, it just didn't touch me. I just didn't care. And that isn't how you're supposed to feel. So I'm really glad I had a chance to see this. I'm really glad I got a cheap seat to see it. And I'm sure it brings a lot of joy to a lot of people. But I'm looking forward to having something else on stage that I can enjoy. Maybe I'm just grumpy. Yeah. So I'm not Web Cowgirl. I'm like the grumpy web critic, the grumpy blogger. Web Cowgirl, grumpy blogger.
We're now going to talk about The Brother's Sighs at the Young Vic. This is a play by Terrell Alvin McCraney and directed by Bijan Shabani. It stars Jonathan Ajayi, Sope Disiru, and Anthony Welsh, and Manuel Pinheiro providing a percussive musical score. It has a very simple design by Patrick Bernier, which is really a circle in the centre of the ground where they sprinkle on some red dust at the beginning of the play, and it gets sort of trodden in as the play continues. This play has gained a lot of attention because it was first performed at the Young Vic in 2007, and since then, Terrell Alvin McCraney has received an Oscar for Moonlight, for Best Adapted Screenplay from his play Moonlight. So he gets a lot more attention, but this play shows just how good he was way back then. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, I saw the original production 10 years ago, and it's actually the second part of a trilogy. And when it was put on at the Young Vic in 2007, it was put on before the first part of the trilogy, which was put on a year later, which is called Red and Brown Water. And we actually haven't seen the third part of the trilogy at all. So it doesn't feel like it is part of a trilogy for that reason, really. And as you say, I mean, he's gone on to win the Oscar last year for Moonlight. But he also did a couple of other things in the UK. He did Wig Out and Choir By with the Royal Court. But he also did some work with the RSC, particularly with work for young people. And it's a very early revival, I think, 10 years. We don't often see a play coming back 10 years later. I think it's associated with the anniversary of the Actors Touring Company, which is the co-producer with the Young Vic. And as you say, it's directed by Bijan Shabani, and in fact, the whole creative team are kind of back together again, really. It does concern his two brothers, surname is Sighs, and the younger brother, Ushushi, leaves prison and goes to stay with his elder brother, Ogun, and indeed also works with him in his car repair business. And then one of Oshusi's fellow prisoners, a chap called Elegba, comes to see him. And, you know, they have known each other in prison. And I think he threatens the bond, really, between the brothers. And what we're experiencing is the up-and-down relationship played out over 80 minutes or so, without an interval. As you say, it's staged without any set and without any props. They mark this chalk circle at the beginning, and then this red chalk is thrown on the floor, and because of the movement around, it gets sort of A on them, and B gets rubbed into the floor. And one of the sort of quirkiest things about it is that the actors often sort of announce their entrances and exits, and other kind of stage directions direct to the audience. And it's also got some very stylized movement. And as you mentioned, the live soundtrack, there's also this kind of atmospheric soundtrack. I think all of those things combine to make something that's really quite compelling to watch. And at times it's sort of, you know, it's quite mesmerizing and hypnotic. There is apparently Yoruba mythology within the play, but I'm afraid I didn't get that at all, really. And I also struggled a bit with the dialect set in Louisiana. There's a very strong dialect, so I didn't pick up all of the dialogue. But that notwithstanding, I think it's a very, very compelling. It's a very watchable piece. Anthony Welsh, who's the fellow prisoner, Legba, is very good. And he actually was in the original production. So in addition to the creatives, he's actually come back again. So Pierre Doster, we've seen quite a bit lately. He was at Cassius Clay in One Night in Miami at the Donmar, and he was the RSC's latest Coriolanus, tail end of last year. And he continues to impress. I think he's very, very good here as Zogan. And Jonathan Ajaya, who I haven't seen before, and I think actually is a bit of a newcomer, fairly sort of soon out of drama school, I thought was hugely impressive as Oshushi, the younger brother, because he has to make a sort of transition from the sort of ex-con with all the bravado you might expect him to come out of prison with to a much more childlike young brother as the story unfolds, really. So I was very glad I went back to see it. I remembered it in a kind of loose sense, but not in detail. And I do feel it was quite ahead of its time then, but I also think it is quite ahead of its time now. It's a very, very original piece. It's got a very short run. I don't know why, but it's only running for sort of 3 weeks or so, but it might already be too late. But certainly something to recommend.
I remember being impressed by this when I first saw it, and even more impressed now. I thought it was a very interesting and clever play. I mean, the idea of doing their own stage direction is a little bit strange, but I remember that from the first time round. So it's not a decision. It's a sort of this deliberate meta-theatricality. I don't know. I don't want to say that. It works really extremely well. And, you know, 90 minutes, I think everybody was extremely impressed. And the way that they've done it, I mean, because it's in this sort of thing is in the round. It's, we are very on very sort of steeply raked seats. You do feel very much part of the action in there and very much part of this play. I do wonder, you know, if the hold that this ex-con has over Oshi, the younger brother, is a sexual one. I think it's sort of intimated at least that there was, that you know, they had to cling together to survive in prison, and he's getting him into trouble now. Yeah, I thought it was really quite a fascinating play, and I was very glad to see it back, and yeah, it's a bit of a pity they're only doing it for, you know, a few weeks.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page of Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.